Hello there. This is the On Science podcast from NPR. I'm science correspondent Joe Palca. This week, we go from deep below the Antarctic ice to way, way out in space. I'll also tell you about the genome of some tiny little critters that can grow helmets and spears. Wow. But we're going to start with a list of items that used to be popular. Horse-drawn buggies, chariots, detachable collars on men's shirts, top hats, corsets. Once upon a time, these things were everywhere, and now they're gone. Or are they? Robert Krulwich found to his great surprise that old things don't disappear like you'd think.
We invent things, and then after a while, some of those things disappear because we don't need them anymore. Everybody knows that. But no, says Kevin Kelly, human inventions don't disappear. They just don't ever.
I say that there's no species of technology that have ever gone globally extinct on this planet.
Which means what?
That means that things that are invented don't die off.
What?
I can't find anything that has disappeared completely from the Earth.
There's got to be things. There's got to be things. Before we get into this, you should know Kevin Kelly was founding editor of Wired magazine. He runs an influential blog called Cool Tools about new technology. But apparently he did not notice, for example, that nobody makes carbon paper anymore.
I'm willing to bet. I mean, I'll take your challenge of carbon paper, but okay. I'm going to go all the way on this. And so I can find no case of an invention that is not being used somewhere on Earth today still.
And then he made this ridiculous bet. He said, I bet you can't find any tool, any machine, go back to any century you like, that still isn't being made and made new today. So all I have to do is find a single tool that's not being made anymore, and
yeah,
I win.
Right.
You're so going to lose this. How about a Paleolithic axe? Stone axe? Yeah, stone axe.
Stone axe still being made almost exactly the same way today.
And who's making them? I mean,
who is making them? Yeah. Well, lots and lots of people from all walks of life, all over the country. And
I'm talking about ancient hammers here.
Yes.
John Whitaker, who teaches anthropology at Grinnell College in Iowa, says there are hobbyists by the thousands who buy Paleolithic hammers to make arrowheads for fun. I mean, you're talking about history buffs here, right?
Yes.
But that doesn't mean, though, that everything gets remade. I mean, nobody makes, I don't know, like steam-powered car engines anymore.
Actually, they do.
And sure enough, I looked online and I found Jay Leno showing off a steam-powered car engine.
This is a 10 horsepower, which 10 doesn't sound like much, but it makes a lot of torque.
You can actually buy brand new parts for your steam-powered car.
So people who collect old cars, toys, planes, typewriters, they need new parts. So this is getting a little harder than I thought.
Yeah, right.
So maybe because he was feeling so confident, Kevin confessed that at one point he'd found a copy of an 1895 Montgomery Ward catalog, which is kind of like a Sears catalog from 115 years ago. And just to test himself, he turned to the farming section thinking,
there's got to be really weird farm implements that are dead, that are extinct.
And what happened?
We went through, and in every case, we were able to find...
You just said every case. Do you mean every...
Every case. Everything on that page, they were still being manufactured new.
No.
Shockingly, yes.
No.
Yes.
Okay, so now I know how to, I know I'm going to win this bet. I'm going to go through not just that page. I'm going to go through page after page after page of the Montgomery Ward catalog until I find something, which I will, that is not being made anymore. So I'm going to do this by calling...
This is Shad Malady.
In
Nevada, Iowa.
At what store?
A company called Almaco.
And Almaco sells farm equipment?
Yeah.
And they sell to suppliers in India and Africa, as well as to religious customers like the Amish who choose old tools. And you're going to help me out.
Okay.
Okay. So do you guys at Almaco sell, and this is from the 1895 catalog, do you sell a corn bean seed planter that you can jab into the ground?
We have what's called our jab planter.
It's a jabber?
It's exactly what it is. Yeah,
okay.
We have actually two styles that we make, yes.
Okay, well, how about, do you have a hill-dropping fertilizer drill?
Sorry to disappoint you, but yes, we do.
How about a little giant broadcast hand seeder? This is a hand seeder you roll with a wheel in the front?
We make them.
Do you make a tornado tank pump?
I've heard of them.
Is there any tool you've got that you know of that's gone extinct? I mean, no one makes it all anywhere in the world?
That's a good question.
Uh-huh.
You know, you got me.
I can't believe this is so difficult. Kevin, stop laughing. Because I'm going to tell you the truth. I asked two really good sleuths, NPR's Jessica Goldstein and Mike Rucco, to go item by item through 6 pages of the 1895 catalog. And I said, find me something that isn't being made today. And Mike reported back.
We definitely were able to find everything that you listed.
Everything.
Yeah.
And then to make matters even worse, Professor Whitaker back in Grinnell, he said, you know, if you add up, you know, Stone Age tribes that still exist and poor farmers and modern hobbyists, for different reasons, people do hang on to old tools, which makes it kind of likely that they would last and last.
Yeah. That's not an unreasonable proposition. I think the longevity of basic technologies is astounding.
Carbon paper, by the way, I found at my local stationery store, so that's out. But that's when a Mr. Lehman, who sells farm equipment in Ohio, told us about an obscure grain drill, whatever that is no longer being made.
No.
So the 5-hole, 1-box grain drill you think is a completely extinct item?
I think so.
Let me be careful here, because this would be, for me, bingo.
Yeah, okay, let's go bingo.
Okay.
So this thing is no longer being made? Is that what you're claiming?
That's what I'm claiming. It's no longer being made.
They have grain drills, but not a small one like that.
Okay, so I'm going to give Kevin as much time as he needs to get himself out of this suddenly deep hole he finds himself in. And in like no time.
Already? I just spent about 2 minutes Googling, and I found a place in India, which I suspected, and it's a 3-hole, 1-box grain drill.
Is the 3-hole, 1-box grain drill being made new?
Yes, it's brand new, and they also do custom, so if you really wanted a 5-hole one, they would make a 5-hole one for you.
I'm running out of steam here. I can't.
So the idea is that there is basically no extinct technology, that everything that we have made in the past is still being made somewhere in the world today.
I so know you're wrong. But I just can't prove it. Robert Krulwich, NPR News.
Robert continued his search for extinct tools on his blog, npr.org/Krulwich. Head over there to see more. Russian scientists are on the verge of punching a hole into a vast Antarctic lake that's buried under more than 2 miles of ice. If the Russians break through, they may tap into a primitive ecosystem that has been undisturbed for millions of years. Some people worry that may disturb that pristine ecosystem. NPR's Richard Harris reports.
Lake Vostok is actually the third largest lake in the world, measured by the amount of water it holds. And if you're surprised to learn that there could be a vast pool of liquid water under 2 miles of ice, so were the Soviets. In fact, they had no idea there was a lake there when they built a camp at Vostok, Antarctica, more than 50 years ago. Robin Bell from the Lamont Doherty Earth Observatory says the Soviets picked the spot because it was the Earth's magnetic south pole.
The Russians went to the magnetic south pole in 1958 because they missed the race to the rotational south pole.
The U.S. claimed that prime real estate, and it turns out the south magnetic pole isn't fixed in one place. In fact, it wandered off from Camp Vostok, leaving the Soviet base seemingly in the middle of nowhere. Undaunted, the Russians drilled down through the ice at their feet to sample tiny air bubbles trapped inside. And in the early 1990s, they recreated a history of the Earth's atmosphere throughout the last 400,000 years. Bell says the hole they drilled was more than 2 miles deep.
When they got to the bottom, they suddenly found this ice that didn't seem to be the same. It had giant crystals, it was a different acidity, and there were no gas bubbles in it.
Gradually, scientists realized that this odd layer of ice was actually from the roof of an enormous lake buried directly beneath them.
And right about then, the satellite imagery came out, and you could see that this area the size of New Jersey was dead flat, and there was a lake.
Ever since, Russians have been dying to complete their hole into the lake.
So the real question is there life in Lake Vostok?
And if there is, how old would it be?
Well, as I like to think of it, this lake hasn't had the wind blow across it for maybe 35 million years, but the water's changed every tens of thousands of years. So the water's relatively new. The lake is old.
But getting a sample was no simple matter. It took Russian scientists more than a decade to come up with an acceptable plan for drilling into the lake without disturbing it. They started drilling down again in early January. Jim Barnes has been watching this process closely as head of a non-governmental organization called the Antarctic and Southern Ocean Coalition.
Well, to be perfectly honest, we are not very happy about it.
Of major concern is the Russians have filled the hole they're drilling with more than 14,000 gallons of kerosene and freon in order to prevent it from freezing shut. The Russians have engineered their system so that when they break through into the lake, water pressure from below is supposed to push the drilling fluids up the hole rather than letting them pour into the lake and contaminating it. But Barnes is nervous.
Nobody needs to go into this particular lake or any particular lake tomorrow. There's no driving need for it. Why take risks that are unnecessary?
Another worry is that the lake water could come rushing up the hole. John Preskew from Montana State University says the water in the lake is gassy, and if the Russians aren't careful, the lake water could spew out like a shaken bottle of soda.
That would be a very bad thing if it did it. Your guys are out through the top, and you would drain the lake into the atmosphere. I mean, there's 5,400 cubic kilometers of water in that lake.
So you think it would all come out?
A lot. Yeah, it would just keep blasting out until it degassed.
Preskew isn't expecting a disaster, but if there is one, he says it could set back plans by U.S. scientists, including himself, and British scientists to drill into two other buried Antarctic lakes in the coming years. Robin Bell from Lamont Doherty says it's a matter of Russian pride to get this right.
They didn't get to the moon first. They really, really want to be the first people to drill into a subglacial lake, and they want to do it right.
And this story, for now, is probably going to end as a cliffhanger. The head of the Russian program told NPR on Wednesday that they have about 100 feet left to drill. But this cold place is about to turn even colder as the seasons change, so the drilling crew needs to fly out on Sunday, and they're unlikely to be done by then. Richard Harris, NPR News.
A NASA orbiting telescope has detected a slew of planet candidates, more than 1,000, and dozens of those planets are in the so-called habitable zone around their stars where life might exist. Here's NPR's Nell Greenfield-Boyce.
The Kepler telescope was launched back in 2009 to try to find planets similar to Earth, rocky, potentially habitable alien worlds. Since then, the telescope has been staring at over 150,000 stars in one small patch of sky. It's looking for the slight dimming in the brightness of stars that could be caused by a passing planet. Today, NASA held a press conference, and William Borucki, the mission's principal investigator, said that in its first 4 months of operation, Kepler found an amazing number of events that could mean a planet is circling a star. The telescope has found 1,235 possible planets, to be precise. The amount of dimming reveals the planet's size, and Borucki says these possible planets come in all sizes.
We see 68 Earth size, 288 super Earth size. We're seeing 662 Neptune size, 165 Jupiter size.
And Borucki says that 54 of the candidates seem to be located in their star's habitable zone, where temperatures are not too hot and not too cold, meaning there could be liquid water.
One of which you can see is smaller than Earth. Four of them are somewhat larger than Earth. They're super Earth size.
A planet this size might be rocky. And the thought of a rocky planet in the habitable zone is the kind of thing that thrills planet hunters. It's the kind of place that ET might call home. Remember, though, that these are all just candidate planets. Doing follow-up observations to show that all these dimming events detected by Kepler are truly planets will take time. Now that NASA has released all this data, researchers can get to work. Deborah Fisher is an astronomer at Yale University. She called this a historic moment.
Kepler has blown the lid off of everything that we know about extrasolar planets. And this week, to me, feels very different than last week did.
NASA officials point out that in the first 15 years of planet hunting from the ground, scientists had managed to find only about 500 planets, mostly big gas balls like Jupiter. Even if not all of Kepler's 1,200 or so possible planets pan out, the orbiting telescope is giving scientists an unprecedented sense of what's out there, and the mission isn't over yet. Nell Greenfield Boyce, NPR News.
Imagine a creature that can grow its own spear and helmet when threatened by an attacker. Sounds like fiction, but it's true. The federal government was intrigued enough to fund a major effort to investigate this creature's genetics. A crucial step in that effort is now complete, and the results are quite surprising. Here's the story I did for Morning Edition. Anything that can grow its own armor sounds pretty scary, but it's hard to be afraid of a creature named Daphnia.
Daphnia are small crustacea about the size of an equal sign on your keyboard.
Or about the size of a grain of rice, says John Colborn. He's at the Center for Genomics and Bioinformatics at Indiana University Bloomington. Other crustaceans you might be familiar with are shrimps and lobsters. Daphnia are a bit different.
They are transparent.
Well, so are a lot of us. But in Daphnia's case, it's literally true. You can see right through them. That transparency also led the first scientists who saw Daphnia to think it was a flea.
When they first noticed this organism, sometimes they would be found to be bright red.
So scientists thought they were bloodsuckers and called them water fleas. Turns out they're not bloodsuckers, they're blood makers. Daphnia have genes that make hemoglobin, so when the animal is stressed out, these genes switch on and Daphnia looks red. In fact, Daphnia have an astonishingly large number of genes.
The genome measures only 200 million bases, and yet within this region we count over 31,000 genes.
For comparison, the human genome has more like 23,000 genes. If Guinness tracks such things, Daphnia would hold the record for the most genes of any animal studied to date. And Colborn says Daphnia has another surprise.
Many of those genes, we estimate around 35% of them, are brand new to science.
Colbert and his colleagues are publishing their findings in today's issue of the journal Science. Now, if you're like me, you might be wondering something. Why does a simple organism like Daphnia need more genes than a human being?
It's hard to say need more genes because that would mean that evolution has a goal. In this case, it's obviously found some way to use more genes.
And apparently it uses these genes to cope with its environment. Low oxygen, switch on the hemoglobin genes. Predators around, switch on the armor-making genes. And on and on and on. Jeff Dudica of the University of South Carolina says knowing the DNA sequence of Daphnia is particularly useful because many of the animals used for genetic research have only been studied in the lab.
It's virtually impossible to figure out much about their ecology in nature.
But ecologists have been studying Daphnia for years. Now they think they can link all that ecological research with the new genetic research. Saren Twombly is a program officer at the National Science Foundation, one of the federal agencies that supported the investigation of Daphnia's genetics. She agrees that Daphnia provides some unique research opportunities.
What is it about the genome that allows an organism to be so flexible in response to its environment?
Twombly says you shouldn't be surprised that it's possible to learn something fundamentally important about life on Earth from a critter about the size of a grain of rice.
Most of what we know about biology comes from decidedly uncharismatic organisms, worms, flies, bugs. We can grow them easily. We know what to feed them. We can do experiments with them. We can't do any of that stuff with lions and tigers and bears.
Oh, my, no. That would make the laboratory a pretty scary place to work. Joe Palca, NPR News, Washington. In the Super Bowl, any player who takes a shot to the head and shows signs of a concussion will be taken out of the game. But it's a different story for high school athletes who sometimes play on despite a head injury. NPR's John Hamilton reports on a new effort to pass laws to protect the brains of young athletes.
Each year, more than 60,000 high school athletes sustain a concussion.
It's an injury that temporarily affects brain function, though it may or may not cause a person to lose consciousness. And it's not just football players who get concussions. It's male and female athletes involved in soccer, wrestling, basketball, baseball, field hockey, even volleyball. And many of these athletes never get an evaluation that would reveal their injury. Jeff Miller of the National Football League says there's a simple reason.
Unfortunately, kids at the high school level, at the youth sports level, don't have neurosurgeons, neurologists, and some of the finest doctors on the sidelines. It's just not practicable.
So the NFL, the American College of Sports Medicine, and a long list of other groups are joining forces to require other measures to protect young athletes. Miller says the coalition wants every state to have a law like the one passed in Washington in 2009.
Washington State was the first to pass a law named after a youth football player named Zachary Leistat, who was a terrific kid and suffered some debilitating injuries as a result of a concussion suffered in a youth football game.
Leistat's head hit the ground in the first half, but he was allowed to keep playing. And when he took another shot to the head late in the game, the result was devastating. The Leistat law says an athlete suspected of having a head injury must be removed from competition. That's because even a minor injury to the brain can make it highly vulnerable to further damage. A concussion law might have helped Sarah Rainey, a high school soccer player in Alexandria, Virginia. During a game 10 months ago, she took a violent hit.
I thought I just got the wind knocked out of me, and I told my coaches and the trainer that I was okay. I passed the sideline evaluation, and I played the remaining 5 minutes and then two overtime periods.
But after the game, she began experiencing headaches, nausea, and fuzzy thinking. Rainey tried to go back to school, but everything about it made her symptoms worse.
Small print reading for homework or computer screen, the lights, and there were several things, and just even fluctuations in my teachers' voices would trigger my headaches and make me seasick.
It was 2 months before Rainey could get through a full day of school and 4 months before her brain was back to normal. She was treated by Dr. Jerry Joya at Children's National Medical Center in Washington, D.C. Joya is part of the coalition pushing for concussion laws. He says no law could have prevented Rainey's concussion, but a law might have helped limit the damage.
The problem is that she was let back into the game later on, and it's hard to know exactly the contribution of that. She didn't take another hit, but certainly she was overworking that body and brain during the period of this metabolic crisis.
Joya says Rainey also returned to class too soon, something else a law could have prevented. He says an injured brain is like a sprained ankle. It heals faster if you don't use it too much.
As you're learning and thinking and doing all that good performance activity in the school, that's demanding more from your brain than it can handle. It's taking away the important energy toward recovery, and it basically then is affecting negatively your recovery.
Joya says the coalition wants concussion laws to include provisions for easing injured students back into the classroom. But for the laws to work, athletes who take a blow to the head need a proper evaluation. Jim Whitehead of the American College of Sports Medicine says that means involving a medical professional with the right expertise.
You don't want coaches making medical decisions. Sorry, they didn't go to school for that. That isn't their core competency. So you want to take any of those things out of the hands of people who really aren't qualified to make those judgments and put it in the hands of professionals who are.
Whitehead says what coaches should do is learn the subtle signs that could mean a concussion.
And if there's any doubt whatsoever, you sit the athlete until he or she has been cleared by a health professional.
About 10 states, including Virginia, have passed youth concussion laws. The coalition's goal is to get laws in at least 10 more states by the end of the year. John Hamilton, NPR News.
And that's it for On Science. We'll have more coverage from the NPR Science Desk next week. I'm Joe Palca.